Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. Global oil prices dropped immediately Tuesday with the prospect of a flood of new Iranian oil on the world market after Tehran and six world powers agreed to restraints on Iran's nuclear development program. Brent crude fell 2.3%. That's down $1.35 a barrel to $56.50. The price for U.S. benchmark oil declined 2%, down $1.05 to 51.15 cents. The Iranian oil exports have been crippled in the face of the 2012 economic sanctions imposed by the United Nations, the United States, and other Western powers to pressure Tehran into negotiating a deal to block its development of nuclear weaponry. President Obama said the deal demonstrates that American diplomacy can bring about real and meaningful change.
Today, because America negotiated from a position of strength and principle, we have stopped the spread of nuclear weapons in this region. Because of this deal, the international community will be able to verify that the Islamic Republic of Iran will not develop a nuclear weapon.
The president spoke immediately after the announcement in Vienna by the EU Foreign Affairs Chief, Federica Mogherini.
It is a decision that can open the way to a new chapter in international relations and show that diplomacy, coordination, cooperation can overcome decades of tensions and confrontations.
Meanwhile, early congressional reaction to the landmark agreement signed with Iran appears to be largely split down party lines, with Democratic lawmakers appearing cautiously optimistic and Republicans questioning it. VOA News. The United Nations is calling for the immediate cessation of attacks targeting civilians in Afghanistan, condemning the wounding or killing of more than 100 civilians in the past 2 days. UN envoy to Kabul, Nicholas Haysom, said the cold statistics of civilian casualties do not adequately capture the horror these bombs cause, the torn bodies of children, wives, daughters, sons, and fathers. These are the real consequences of those acts of terror. He called the acts cynical, cowardly, and saying they are bereft of humanity and in violation of national and international law. Two explosions have rocked a chemical plant near the Marseille-Provence airport in southern France. Authorities there say they have launched an inquiry into the incident that occurred Tuesday morning. It came as the country began celebrations for its National Bastille Day. No injuries were reported, and the blasts are being treated as a coincidental incident. The Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras had less than 48 hours Tuesday to pass a series of pro-market reforms in Parliament and smother dissent from hardliners within his own ranks as he races to meet the terms of an unpopular bailout deal. Having staved off financial meltdown with a new agreement from Greece's international creditors, Tsipras now faces the anger of both lawmakers and the public for agreeing to measures that are much tougher than those rejected in a referendum on July 5th. That's ambulances that you hear in India, where authorities there say at least 27 people have been killed after a stampede on the banks of a river where pilgrims had gathered to observe a Hindu religious bathing festival. That stampede occurred Tuesday in the southern state of Andhra Pradesh. The Prime Minister Narendra Modi issued a statement on his Twitter account saying he was deeply pained by that tragedy. The Associated Press reports that Nokia is seeking a world-class partner to get back into the cell phone business. The Finnish company says it hopes to return to designing and providing technology for cell phones, but needs a partner to manufacture, market, and sell those devices. An unmanned U.S. space probe is to become the first to explore the distant dwarf planet of Pluto Tuesday. It's called the New Horizons Space Probe, and this is lead scientist Alan Stern.
50 years ago today, the first spacecraft flew by Mars. It's called Mariner 4. And I think it's fitting that on that 50th anniversary, we complete the initial reconnaissance of the planets with the exploration of Pluto.
It will take more than half a day before ground controllers at NASA get a signal from the probe saying that it safely reached Pluto. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiyis Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni headed to Burundi Tuesday in hopes of mediating a solution to the country's political crisis. The Ugandan president's visit comes a week before elections in Burundi, in which President Pierre Nkurunziza will run for a controversial third term in office.
That's VOA's Gabe Joslow reporting. Details next.
Also, the United Nations says the Millennium Development Goals for reducing HIV infections and AIDS-related deaths have been met. And police in Nigeria's Borno State say an estimated 43 people have been killed by suspected Boko Haram gunmen.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports, music from South Africa, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on African News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni headed to Burundi today in hopes of mediating a solution to the country's political crisis. VOA's Gabe Joslow reports the Ugandan president's visit comes a week before elections in Burundi, in which President Pierre Nkurunziza will run for a controversial third term in office.
The East African Community, a regional bloc, appointed Mr. Museveni to facilitate a political dialogue in Burundi, where the opposition has staged weeks of protests against President Nkurunziza for his plans to run for another term. The president's opponents say a third term would violate the constitution and the accords that ended Burundi's civil war in 2005. With only a week to go before the scheduled vote, it is uncertain how effective Mr. Museveni's visit will be, says Thierry Verculon, Central Africa Project Director for International Crisis Group.
In addition to the fact that the main issue, which is the third term of President Nkurunziza, is non-negotiable, you have a clear divide within the region.
Verculon says the absence of Rwandan President Paul Kagame from EAC meetings on Burundi is a sign that the region is not united in its approach. Meanwhile, there are concerns that the opposition, which has boycotted the upcoming poll, could turn increasingly violent. Mr. Nkurunziza already survived a coup attempt in May. A former military commander who supported the coup has been threatening further action.
It's pretty clear that opposition has already started in Burundi. What is going on is pretty obvious now, and there's not much room for dialogue at this stage.
Burundian forces say they confronted suspected armed rebels in a northern province last week, arresting about 170 members of the unidentified group. More than 70 people have been killed since March in the capital, Bujumbura, in protests in which demonstrators have clashed with police. The United Nations says more than 160,000 people have fled Burundi for neighboring countries. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Nairobi.
Smugglers have tricked more than 10,000 refugees into seeking a safe haven in Yemen, even after Houthi rebels captured Yemen's capital Sana'a and triggered a civil war. The UN Refugee Agency says most of the refugees duped into the dangerous sea crossing were from Ethiopia. In 2014, the Ethiopian government repatriated a large number of Ethiopians who had sought asylum in Yemen while transiting to find jobs in Saudi Arabia. The UNHCR says more than 37,000 migrants have sailed to troubled Yemen this year. East African migrants who risk their lives crossing the Red Sea have now joined more than a million Yemenis displaced by the war.
A new United Nations report on AIDS says the Millennium Development Goals of reducing HIV infections and AIDS-related deaths have been met. Marta van der Wolf reports from Addis Ababa.
According to UN statistics, since the year 2000, new HIV infections have fallen by 35% and AIDS-related deaths by 41%. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon outlined the good news to reporters in Addis Ababa on Tuesday.
Today, 15 million people are on life-saving HIV treatment. We have proved beyond doubt that treatment can be scaled up, no matter what the setting. 15 million people on HIV treatment means millions of families are protected and billions of dollars saved. And it means we are on our way for an AIDS-free generation.
Sub-Saharan Africa has always been the worst affected part of the world when it comes to AIDS. But progress is being made, with Namibia, Senegal, and Ethiopia being examples of countries that have significantly reduced new HIV infections. The report says access to treatment has saved about 7.8 million lives worldwide. Treatment also means that an estimated 1.4 million children did not receive HIV from their mothers. Also, UNAIDS Executive Director Michel Sidibé said that starting 6 to 8 months from now, HIV-positive people will be able to stop taking their daily pills.
Soon, we know that we will have one injection for every 4 months or 6 months, so which is changing completely the way we will deliver services to poor people. They will not have to travel. They will not have to come. They will not have to stock, certainly, those pills and to have a risk to have pills which are not necessarily working, which creating resistance.
The injection will reduce the cost of treatment for those affected. Despite these promising developments, more needs to be done. In 2014, there were still 2 million new HIV infections, and more than 13 million children lost one or both parents to AIDS-related causes. Later this year, the UN Millennium Development Goals will be replaced with the Sustainable Development Goals. The new target for 2030 is to completely eradicate the AIDS epidemic and for everyone to have access to treatment. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
Low-income countries are being called on to generate their own financial resources for development. One of the ways they can do that is through taxes. It's being discussed at the Third International Conference on Financing for Development in Addis Ababa. VOA's Jody Kapowa reports.
Britain's Institute for Development Studies has issued a policy brief on building tax capacity in developing countries. It says that governments will be urged to tax more effectively, and donors will be called upon to build the capacity to do so. Professor Mick Moore is CEO of the International Center for Tax and Development and one of the authors of the brief.
I think there's now a very widespread understanding that a lot of low-income countries could probably raise more of their own money themselves, and many of them understand this. You know, we've had an era of what I call big aid for quite a long time now, and I think it's clear to most people in the world that that era of big aid is going to draw to an end.
He says donors would continue providing aid for such things as humanitarian emergencies. Many low-income countries, he says, would be happier if they were not dependent on donors and could just raise their own money. Labeling a country low-income may give the impression that it does not have much of a tax base. Moore disagrees.
Well, it's not really the case. Even low-income countries have a tax base. It's not as big as the tax base in the US or the UK, but it's quite substantial and it's not always tapped into very well. So there is certainly scope for doing better there.
The IDS professorial fellow says building taxation capacity in a low-income country does not necessarily mean taxing poor people.
There's a great deal of tax evasion, and the worst tax evasion that happens in low-income countries is not actually poor people, but it's because there are a lot of unrecorded transactions in the economy. Doctors, lawyers, consultants, dentists, artists, architects, professional people of all kind operate on a cash basis, and they don't pay taxes. Large numbers of people own a lot of property. Property taxes are extremely low in most low-income countries.
Moore says low-income countries already have a tax foundation to build on.
Even the lowest-income countries all have a system of taxation at present, and that system of taxation actually doesn't look a million miles different from the taxation system you'll find in the US. So it's not as if they've got to start from nothing. It's just that they have a machine there and they're not using the machine to quite its capacity.
One reason is a lack of staff well-versed in tax matters. That's due to qualified people taking jobs in the private sector. Moore says other reasons include a lack of commitment by the government to do something about taxation, or the government being too eager to give tax breaks to foreign investors. The Institute for Development Studies policy brief says successful tax collection is based on trust.
We have a long history now of rich countries trying to support the development of organizations in low-income countries. When we're giving the money, we want to do it our way, according to our timetable, and we want our experts to visit there when it's suitable for us. But in many cases, and especially true, I think, in the tax field, where you have quite a few rather well-educated people, they often know what their problem is. They don't need us to tell them what the problem is, but they genuinely do need our help in solving it.
Building partnerships, he says, establishes better relationships and brings better results. As the policy brief puts it, mentoring is better than training. Moore says it's not clear how much an improved tax capacity would stem illicit flows of money. He describes it as a very, very contested issue.
We know that there is quite a lot of illicit flows of money from low-income countries. You know, this goes through banks, and much of this is suspicious money, it's corruption money, and it ends up in someplace in the rich world or in a tax haven world. That's one thing, but that is not all potential taxable income for the government. Indeed, most of it isn't potential taxable income for the government. So even if you enormously cut down on the illicit flows, you wouldn't necessarily make a big impact on the taxation issue.
Several African countries have sharply improved their reputations for tax collections. These include Kenya, Mozambique, and Tanzania. Moore says building tax capacity in low- and middle-income countries is a fashionable subject right now among donors. However, he says, donors often make big commitments but fail to follow through several years later. One reason is that tax authorities in rich countries are reluctant to release qualified personnel to go work in developing countries because there's so much work to do at home. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 18 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni headed to Burundi today in hopes of mediating a solution to the country's political crisis. And a new United Nations report on AIDS says the Millennium Development Goals of reducing HIV infections and AIDS-related deaths have been met. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
Diplomats in Vienna say Iran and six world powers have reached a historic deal capping nearly a decade of diplomacy that would curb Tehran's atomic program in return for sanctions relief. Under the agreement, reached after several missed deadlines, Iran would accept curbs on its nuclear program. This in exchange for a comprehensive lifting of sanctions imposed by the United Nations and by individual countries. Tehran also will subject its nuclear facilities to a more rigorous inspections regime. The agreement will take effect only after it clears several hurdles in Washington as well as Tehran. The greatest hurdle will be the U.S. Congress, where Republicans have a majority and are expected to vote against the deal after a review period of up to 60 days. President Barack Obama is expected to veto any negative vote.
Police in Nigeria's Borno state say an estimated 43 people have been killed by suspected Boko Haram gunmen. They burned homes and shot residents in three remote villages 60 miles off the state capital of Maiduguri, Kalawa, Misala, and Gualam. Boko Haram has not declared the responsibility for the attacks, which occurred over the weekend. News of the attacks was delayed because communication lines have been severed by the militants. Police say many other Boko Haram attacks have gone unreported.
President Muhammadu Buhari sacked Nigeria's much-criticized military leadership yesterday and appointed his own men. Chris Stein reports from VOA's regional bureau in Dakar on how this new team is expected to shape Nigeria's fight against Boko Haram.
The shakeup came nearly 7 weeks after President Buhari's May inauguration, amid a rising tide of violence by the Islamist insurgent group Boko Haram. The military has long been seen as ineffective at stopping the group. Boko Haram managed to overrun a chunk of Nigeria the size of Belgium before losing much of that territory earlier this year in an offensive by soldiers from Nigeria and its neighbors, along with foreign mercenaries. But since Mr. Buhari took office, the terrorist group has resumed attacks in force. Deadly bombings and shootings are reported almost daily across Nigeria's north. Senior research fellow at the Institute for Security Studies in South Africa, David Zunmeno, says the new leadership gives Mr. Buhari an opportunity to reform one of the continent's largest armies.
Now the doors are open for him to put new structures in place, new individuals in place, and create the synergy that is needed domestically to really help give sense to the national strategy to fight general insecurity.
Analyst Jan St. Pierre of the Berlin-based security firm Mosikon says the shakeup shows how President Buhari plans to focus on Borno, the vast northeastern state where Boko Haram got its start and where it launches attacks regularly. New Army Chief Major General T.Y. Baratai and new National Security Advisor retired Major General Babagana Monguno are from Borno. The president also moved the military command to the state capital, Maiduguri, soon after taking office.
He's regionalizing the army's strategy into is trusting Borno men to conduct a Borno policy to ensure that it's becoming a more of a local strategy adapted to the needs of the area.
Nigeria's armed forces have lately been dogged by mutinies, allegations of corruption and human rights abuses, along with lingering questions about its inability to defeat the insurgency. St. Pierre says the new leadership shows Mr. Buhari expects things to change.
Buratai is a highly respected man, and Monguno as well. They have what appears to be a strong, incorruptible reputation.
The new leadership will also be responsible for guiding Nigeria's role in a five-nation task force that is expected to deploy at the end of the month. Its target, Boko Haram. Chris Stein for VOA News, Dakar.
A growing number of migrants are crossing the Aegean Sea from Turkey to one of scores of Greek islands off its coast. From there, they try to travel through Greece to weather European Union states, including Germany, Spain, and Great Britain. The EU's efforts to stop the flow have been hampered by Greece's economic crisis. It has left it Athens less money to patrol borders, process migrants for asylum, and provide medical and humanitarian support to overcrowded detention centers. Reporter William Eagle has this update.
For the UN Refugee Agency, the numbers tell the story. 155,000 migrants have arrived in Greece this year, almost half by sea. UNHCR spokesperson Laura Badouan says up to 1,000 people every day are reaching the islands off the Greek mainland. Most of them come from Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan. Perhaps 10% are from Eritrea, Sudan, or other countries in East Africa and the Middle East. They leave from 600 kilometers of difficult-to-patrol Turkish coastline for dozens of habitable islands in the Aegean Sea. Padawan reached on the island of Lesbos, says smugglers charge them up to $1,200 per person for small and crowded dinghies to take them to an EU member state.
I've spoken to a number of refugees who have made the crossing. One of them told me that after 20 minutes out at sea at night, water started coming into the boat. They were absolutely terrified. It was pitch black. They had to just raise the children out of the water in order to keep them safe. Eventually, the Greek Coast Guard did come to find them and rescued them.
Today, there are about 70 beds available in the island's detention center. But more refugees are arriving in Lesbos. Capacity is strained, and the system, says Padawan, is buckling.
There's around 1,000 people camping outside of the center. And then the government has designated another alternative site, which is now an ad hoc refugee camp. And there are around 3,000 people camping there. The services are really, really limited, and people are living in deplorable, squalid conditions.
Padua says the financial crisis put some of UNHCR's programs at risk. In recent weeks, controls have been placed on the amount of cash that can be withdrawn from Greek banks. She says her agency needs ready access to cash for purchasing Greek goods and paying local caterers for food supplies. Humanitarian groups say the country is overwhelmed and are calling attention to Greece's need for help. Amnesty International says Greek efforts to assist the migrants are being hindered by poor planning, ineffective use of EU funds, and a hiring freeze. Philippe Farg is the director of the Migration Policy Center and professor at the European University Institute in Florence, Italy. He says thousands of migrants are passing through Greece without the proper travel documents.
What happens in Greece is already happening in other states, in particular in Italy, which is that the government just closes its eyes on what happens in the first days after the irregular migrants reached the territory. So they will not take the fingerprints, and they will not record these people in real time.
Farg says the EU could consider alternatives, including allowing embassies in Jordan, Turkey, Lebanon, and other states to consider a number of different types of visas for the refugees.
You have many sorts of visas for work, for family reunion, for study, etc. That would be a possibility to alleviate the pressure that is exerted by irregular migrants, because you would offer regular way to reach the territory of the European Union and there to put a claim for asylum. So far, states are reluctant to do it, but I'm pretty sure that they will have to do it.
The UNHCR is calling for the European Union to ramp up its assistance to Greece and to help resettle the refugees. The EU says it's committed to helping Greece with the immigration flow, and a few states are considering increasing the number of migrants. But most EU members have rejected a proposed quota mandating that they accept a percentage of the refugees. The European Asylum Support Office is providing Greece with operational support. In a reply to a VOA query, European Commission spokesperson Natasha Berthaud says Athens will receive almost $290 million for the next 5 years from the EU's Asylum, Migration and Integration Fund. The expenditure will go toward improving living conditions in all reception facilities and screening centers. She says about $1.5 million has been granted to Greece's asylum service. Berthaud adds that so-called hotspot teams will be deployed to Italy and Greece to help them process large numbers of asylum applications. The EU's Justice and Home Affairs Council is also discussing commission proposals to relocate 16,000 people in need of protection who are in Greece and other member states. The European Commission stands ready to assist, says Berthaud, if Athens needs more help. So far, she says, no such request has been received. I'm William Eagle in Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Linor Moudou. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni headed for Burundi today in hopes of mediating a solution to the country's political crisis. A new United Nations report on AIDS says the Millennium Development Goals for reducing HIV infections and AIDS-related deaths have been met. And police in Nigeria's Borno State say an estimated 43 people have been killed by suspected Boko Haram gunmen. Coming up, we'll have music from South Africa and in our feature segment, Birth in the Slums of Nairobi, Kenya, Making Life Dangerous for Pregnant Women. I'm Kim Lewis with Yeheyas Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Of course, it's time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Happy Tuesday, Sunny.
Happy Tuesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you are starting off with Major League Baseball today.
Kim, my opening pitch on the sunny side of sports is Major League Baseball's 86th annual All-Star Game. Great American Ballpark in Cincinnati, Ohio, is the venue for the Great American Ball Game, which will be played later Tuesday night. The popular exhibition contest features the top players in the American League and the National League. Under the current format, all-star players in field positions are selected by fans, all-star pitchers are selected by managers, and all-star reserves are selected by Major League Baseball's managers and players. A record 620 million votes were cast in online balloting for this year's All-Star Game. Toronto Blue Jays third baseman Josh Donaldson set a new record by receiving more than 14 million votes from fans. And one of the big baseball stars based right here in Washington, outfielder Bryce Harper of the Washington Nationals, set a new National League record by receiving almost 13,865,000 votes. The starting pitchers for Tuesday night's All-Star Game are Dallas Keuchel of the Houston Astros, who will be on the mound for the American League, and Zach Greinke of the Los Angeles Dodgers, who will throw for the National League. As part of the All-Star Game festivities, a home run derby was held Monday night, and the winner was a local favorite, third baseman Todd Frazier of the Cincinnati Reds, who plays his home games at Great American Ballpark, edged Los Angeles Dodgers rookie Jock Peterson 15-14 in the final round.
The Voice of America, VOA.
From Cincinnati, Ohio, let's go west to another American city, Kansas City, Kansas, where the United States drew 1-1 with Panama at the Gold Cup football tournament. Joining us now with more details is VOA's Toddy Abeje. Sporty greetings, Toddy.
Sporty greetings, Sonny. The USA had already clinched a berth in the quarterfinals before the draw against Panama. Panama opened the scoring in the 34th minute on a goal by forward Blas Perez. Panama looked very confident that they could beat the Americans, but in the second half, the USA got its attack going. U.S. midfielder Michael Bradley scored the equalizer in the 55th minute after a perfect crossing pass from Alejandro Bedoya. Bradley is the second player other than Clint Dempsey to score a goal in this year's Gold Cup for the U.S. After he gave up the first goal of the game, USA goalkeeper Brad Guzan made six saves. Michael Bradley says the American squad is now looking forward to the knockout round.
It's always tricky when you have one team who's advanced, won the group, and another team playing for everything. At the end of the day, we take our 7 points, first in the group, and now all the focus goes to the quarterfinal in Baltimore Saturday.
As Michael Bradley just said, the USA team now travels to Baltimore, Maryland for a quarterfinal on Saturday. The Americans will play the third place team in either Group B or Group C as they try to defend their Gold Cup title. In another result Monday, Haiti defeated Honduras 1-0 in Kansas City. The Haitians finished second in Group A with 4 points, 3 points behind the USA, and they also advanced to the quarterfinals. I'm VOA's Toddy Abeje. Back to you, Sonny.
Thanks, Toddy. Just ahead on the Sunny Side of Sports, VOA's Tef Tef and Downtown Brown will take a look at AFC Bournemouth, one of the newly promoted football clubs in the English Premier League.
Hey, this is VOA's Downtown Brown.
And I'm Tef Tef.
So this week we're going to be talking about one of the three featured teams that got promoted into Barclays Premier League. And the first team we're going to talk about is AFC Bournemouth.
This is their first time in their history when they got into the Premier League. So it's probably an exciting time for them. They also won the championship, so...
Woo! Congrats to you guys.
I mean, they were the best team last year from the Division 1, so the championship, so...
So we did some of our research for the people who haven't been watching their team actually play this entire past season. We're going to just do a quick overview, players to watch, who they're going to be playing. It's like their first couple matches, see how well they can actually adapt to Barclays Premier League. I think one of the big players we should be focusing on is, you mentioned it too, is...
Oh, yeah, he's one of my players to watch next season.
Yeah, Callum Wilson, amazing striker, amazing speed. If I can relate him to somebody, he'll probably be like a Theo Walcott.
Sure. He's young, but physically a little bit more dominant.
Mm-hmm.
The Premier League is going to be very challenging for him because the defending is a whole different ball game when he can move up to the first league. But mm-hmm. he scored a lot of goals.
He is one of the kind of players who is like gets rebound shots. He's right there, right place at the right time. So
they have three forwards, and between them have, this is Callum Wilson has 23, Jan Kermorgan has 17, and Brett Pittman has 14. So in between them, I mean, that's basically 54 goals.
Yeah.
So that's in between three strikers. So I'm hoping that they can bring the same strike force to the EPL.
There is an African player on the team, Toliko Ranti from South Africa. He has 2 goals. He's actually really fast, too. I was watching some of his old highlights. Very fast. He has an amazing shot, I think, in 2012, 2013. It blew up. It made a big name, but I think he fell off after that. But he's another good player to...
Not a bad return for 16 appearances because, you know, the Wilsons, they've started over 50 times.
Yeah.
And he seems like he's a bench player. And, you know, with 16 appearances, he has 2 goals. So that's decent.
He's understanding his role.
Might not cut in the Premier League, but that's decent.
Some of the matches early on is obviously Liverpool. Yeah. They have August 17th. They got Manchester City October 17th. And then
Tottenham right back.
Yeah, Tottenham right back after that.
And Southampton, I mean, that's actually a pretty tough lineup.
So,
I think if you look at the first 8 games, though, outside of Liverpool, most of these teams, I feel like they could take points off if they can, you know, play the same way they've been playing in the first division.
So where do you think they're going to finish out?
See, the thing about Premier League is you got surprise teams that usually come in, and some of them stick, but Bournemouth being their first time, I think they're going back down.
I think it might be a little bit of a Cinderella story. I think they wouldn't finish in the bottom three. But I think they'll probably finish above Leicester City. So that's it for Bournemouth. Next week, we're going to talk about Watford. I'm VOA's Downtown Brown.
And I'm Tef Tef.
Voice of America.
I'm VOA's Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports. Joining us now from Johannesburg with more sports news is our Daybreak Africa sportsman, Mark Ouma.
We begin with athletics. Nigerian Commonwealth Games long jump champion Brume Ese won women's long jump with a distance of 6.61 meters at the Athletics Federation of Nigeria Golden League meeting in Akure, Ondo State, southwest Nigeria on Saturday. Blessing Ibrahim Ibukun won women's triple jump with a leap of 13.65 meters, while Okpara Tedas won the men's long jump in 7.54 meters. On the track, Adeloye Oluwatosin prevailed in the women's 400 meters in 52.31 seconds as Nathaniel Sampson won the men's race in 46.37 seconds. Daisy Akpofu won women's 400-meter hurdles in 58.29 seconds as Samuel Okori carried the men's race in 51.62 seconds, while Divine Oduduru won men's 200 meters in 21.08 seconds. Turning to football, Japan edged Senegal 4-3 at the FIFA Beach Soccer World Cup in Espino, Portugal on Monday. Today, Tuesday, African champions Madagascar play Paraguay. Meanwhile, Ethiopia held their hosts Cameroon to a scoreless draw in Africa FIFA Under-20 Women's World Cup qualifier in Yaoundé on Sunday. Nigeria overpowered Liberia 7-1. The Democratic Republic of Congo mauled Namibia 4-0. Ghana thrashed Senegal 6-0. South Africa outclassed Botswana 8-1. Equatorial Guinea dismissed Mali 4-0. Burkina Faso edged Algeria 2-1. And Zambia outplayed Tanzania 4-0. Meanwhile, hosts Maghreb Tetouan and the Democratic Republic of Congo's TP Mazembe drew 0-0. In a mini-league Orange Africa Champions League action in Tetouan on Monday morning. In Tunisia, Polish tactician Henry Kasperczak takes the reign as Tunisia's national football coach. The Tunisia Football Federation revealed in Tunis on Monday. Kasperczak, who coached Tunisia in the mid-1990s, takes over from Belgian George Likens. Finally, in volleyball, African champions Kenya beat Peru by 3-1 in the final of their Women's World Volleyball Grand Prix tie in Canberra, Australia on Saturday. Earlier on, Kenyans dismissed Australia 3-1 in the semi-final. Consequently, Kenya is ranked 21st while Algeria is 27th among the 28 teams in the Grand Prix circuit. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa.
Thanks, Mark. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOASunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOASunnySports. I posted a photo at my Facebook page of Wimbledon champions Novak Djokovic and Serena Williams, the world's top-ranked men's and women's tennis players. Responding to the photo, Jeremiah Oteen asked me a question. Sonny, what's your prediction? Will Serena break Steffi Graf's modern open-era record of 22 Grand Slam singles titles? Yes, I think she will, Jeremiah. Serena has 21 now, and I think there's a very good chance she'll tie Graf's record at the U.S. Open in New York in September. And if Serena Williams does win another Grand Slam trophy at the 2015 U.S. Open, she'll become the first women's player since Steffi Graf in 1988 to win all four major titles in the same calendar year. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Thinking Tati Abedje. Yes, thinking Tati Abedje. Back to you, Hayes Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Yes, all right. Thank you, Sonny and Tati, and go Serena. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, birth in the slums of Nairobi, Kenya, making life dangerous for pregnant women. And next, music helping save people's lives in South Sudan. But first, some music from South Africa. Here is Yovan Chaka Chaka with The Power of Africa.
Nature needs a bumper, and I said, you're not.
South Africa's Yvonne Chaka Chaka with the power of Africa.
Well, birth in the slums of Nairobi, Kenya can be tough. The narrow paths between the hundred of shanties of one of Africa's largest slums, Kibera, makes life dangerous for pregnant women who need quick access to medical care when a baby is due. VOA's Lenore Madu has the story in Nairobi.
It is not a five-star ambulance and lacks the normal equipment regular vehicles do. However, for the sick and needy in Kibera, the wheelbarrow ambulance is crucial and it's saving lives.
Mothers who are pregnant, about people who are sick, not able to come to the facility, and there's no way they can be able to be even assisted to come. So we came up with this idea of a wheelbarrow ambulance to assist them.
The wheelbarrow itself is fitted with a mattress and a pair of bedsheets to cover the patient. Kibera is the largest slum in Nairobi, Kenya, with a population of about 500,000 people. Mariam is 5 months pregnant and too weak to walk to the hospital by herself, so she makes an emergency call to Queen Wambua, one of the health workers. They arrive in short time and she's rushed to the hospital. The health workers are equipped with first aid skills to ensure the patient is stable and to avoid more injuries during transportation. Their phone numbers are distributed to residents for faster communication. On a regular basis, the health worker teach the locals basic health awareness and disease prevention techniques.
Each of us was given a couple of houses to go be educating. Personally, I have 88 houses. We teach them basic concepts like boiling water before drinking, washing hands after visiting the toilet. In short, we train them how to protect themselves against preventable diseases.
With its blaring siren and flashing emergency lights, this ambulance is always ready to respond to emergencies in the slum. With impassable roads lined with mud and swarms of people, this is the most effective mode of emergency transport in the slum.
We realized that pregnant women and regular patients had a problem getting to the hospital. Carrying them on our hands was tiresome. A group of people and I approached a donor who made us these wheelbarrow ambulances. This is because vehicles could not reach here. We opted for the wheelbarrow. It can trespass through these tiny roads.
The wheelbarrow ambulance helps pregnant women and bedridden patients who are unable to get themselves to the nearest medical facility. Eventually, Mariam gets to the hospital safely and is diagnosed with malaria. Adults pay the hospital a subsidy of about $1, while children pay 50 cents. Only 4 ambulances serve this population, and there are often delays picking up patients.
If you look at this wheelbarrow ambulance, it is only accessed at the villages we are working with. If we could have more to access to the larger Kibera's community, could be better.
Before the introduction of the wheelbarrow ambulance, doctors say that area mortality rates were higher. The African Medical Research Foundation, AMREF, is the brains behind the project. Their campaign, dubbed Stand Up for African Mothers, aims at reducing maternal mortality on the continent. AMREF hopes to increase the number of wheelbarrow ambulances and also provide car ambulances for patients who need a referral to a better-equipped hospital. Meanwhile, for Nduge and other pregnant women in the slum, the wheelbarrow ambulance and the healthcare that comes with it has increased their chances of a safe delivery.
That was Lenore Madu reporting from Kibera, one of Africa's largest slums.
In 2012, Sudanese filmmaker Hajuj Kuka planned to film a documentary among civil war refugees in Sudan's Blue Nile and Nuba Mountain region. What he found there surprised him. Music was helping to save people from bombing raids by their own government. VOA's Caroline Weaver has the story.
Filmmaker Hajuj Kuka spent 2 years in civil war zones among displaced people in his native Sudan to make his new documentary, Beats of the Antonov. The title refers to two kinds of beats. One is the beat of the music the refugees make in their camps.
It was beautiful, creative music. They all come together and they start dancing and they start playing this music, and the music allows them to be as a community. So it allows them to heal.
He says the players are always creating new songs about their experiences. played on homemade instruments made from things like plates and motorbike brake belts.
Because they ran away without anything. When you're running away, you're not thinking, I'm going to take an instrument. You're thinking, I'm going to carry a baby. And so they just devised these instruments. They're the same old instruments, but actually made out of found objects in the camp.
The other beat in Beats of the Antonov is the beat of death. Shrapnel bombs dropped on the southern Blue Nile and Nuba regions by Sudan's government, using old Soviet Antonov planes. Around the camps, young players stay up all night making music to keep watch for the buzz of oncoming planes.
And there'd be all these different groups that are just playing until the morning. And if they hear the bomb, they just wake up everybody.
Kuka says Sudan's civil war is rooted in the government's forcing an Arab-Islamic national identity throughout Sudan, despite the country's 57 ethnicities and 150 different languages.
So Sudan became this extreme case where you have all these people who feel marginalized, and whatever they try, they can only become Arab to a certain extent. They come to the ceiling, they can't pass it. And to come to the solution is not a simple solution. And that's why we need the discussion to talk about it. But the solution is to create a Sudan that celebrates the 57 different ethnicities, that every single one of them is part of being Sudanese.
Kuka says he thinks the war against Sudan's mostly darker-skinned civilians in the south would end if President Omar al-Bashir were arrested as a war criminal. But until then, he has little hope that peace will come soon. Beats of the Antonov won the People's Choice Award at the Toronto International Film Festival and will air on the POV series on U.S. public television in August. Carolyn Weaver, VOA News, New York.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Jonah Cummings, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The celebrations were muted July 9th as South Sudan celebrated its fourth anniversary of independence. After decades of civil war, the South Sudanese people voted to split from the North, and amid high hopes and much jubilation, the world's newest nation was born July 9th, 2011. But the cheer has turned to gloom in many parts of the East African nation as armed conflict continues. The fighting, now approaching its 20th month, has cost thousands of lives and displaced almost 2 million people. Both government and opposition forces have committed appalling crimes against civilians, including children. President Salva Kiir and Riek Machar and their cronies are personally responsible for ending this conflict and man-made humanitarian crisis. Only leaders on both sides can end this violence. For far too long, they have chosen to haggle over personal power and wealth instead of agreeing on solutions. Meanwhile, the people of South Sudan continue to suffer. Almost half of South Sudan's population is now dependent on international assistance for its very survival. Amid the fighting, the government has failed to protect its citizens and squandered its legitimacy. It has subverted democracy and unilaterally extended its mandate. Both the government and opposition have failed to negotiate a resolution. As the violence drags on, the conflict not only scars the lives of innocent South Sudanese, it threatens to destabilize the wider region. Through all these challenges, the path ahead is clear. Further violence is not the solution. The South Sudanese parties must come to a peace agreement and immediately establish an inclusive transitional government that can serve with legitimacy and represent the needs of the people of South Sudan. With the hopefulness of July 9, 2011 fresh in mind, now is the time to honor fully the cessation of hostilities agreement of January 23rd to end the violence, seek a lasting peace, and fulfill the promise of 4 years ago.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joburg.
Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.